Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Hello, it's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and in case you haven't noticed, well, you probably haven't yet, Mark Maron is on vacation. He is currently gliding over the lip of a volcano in a helicopter with no doors. At least that's what he told us. And we've got B-Mac, Brendan McDonald, and Dan Pashman, the legendary one, both here with us in studio, along with the great Chris Lopresto, who came back a day early from his vacation last Friday. What's up?
How you doing, buddy?
All right, man. How you feeling? How you guys feeling?
Good, man. I appreciate, Riley, that when you're here, man, that when we're not pervaded by the influence of Mark Maron, that I become B Mac.
Yeah, man.
P.W. McDonald.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Hey,
I like it.
Hey, so what's up, man?
Not much. I was over the weekend. We were getting ready to do this show on Monday. I was very happy to come in and have a nice day at work, and I yet was still hit very quickly on Sunday afternoon with the influence of Mark Maron's id.
The id?
Yeah, the id of Mark Maron showed up in my email box, and actually, he wrote to me about a dream he had.
Oh,
and,
Lord.
And, Kalo, actually, do we have some Dream Diary music? Why don't we clip that up there, because that's probably appropriate
for this. Oh, this must be deep.
This. Yeah, all right. So this was Maron's dream. I'll do it in my best Mark Maron, although I don't know that I can really impersonate him here. Leaving for Hawaii in a couple of hours, I had this effed up dream about the show. We were on the air and we had done something really dirty and I felt bad about it. Then I couldn't talk. Words were coming out, but they were all tangled. I kept looking at Riley and he couldn't talk either. He was talking, but it was gibberish. There was some older woman there asking us what was wrong in a pissed off sort of way.
Uh-oh.
I remember thinking that it wasn't a good segment. And then it closes with, I guess I just need the break.
Okay.
If anyone out there is questioning why Mark Maron is not here this week, why is he away on vacation for a full week, it's because we don't want to receive any more emails like this.
Like that. Okay, I understand. Man, we got a show today.
We do.
Maron's missing out, actually, because we're going to talk to Jennifer Senior from New York Magazine about Bill Clinton and his plans for world domination.
Yes.
I'm down. You know, I mean, given Bush's plans for world domination, can Clinton's be worse? Can they honestly be worse?
If we're going to have one of our presidents or former presidents dominating the world, I'd much rather be Bill Clinton than
G.W. Bush.
We'd be smoking good cigars, at least.
Yeah. Absolutely. We've also got, because G.W. has decided to head for Idaho, the only place in the world that still likes him, we're going to be talking to an organizer from the Idaho Peace Coalition. Liz Paul is going to talk to us later in the show about their reception for our president.
Yeah. Did you know what today is in Idaho, Riley?
Yes, it's the anniversary of one Ruby Ridge.
Right. It's a good time for Bush to be going there, I think. Pretty indicative coincidence of why he's there.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been some very interesting stuff going on out by his ranch, which is probably why he got out of Dodge as quickly as possible. But, you know, Cindy Sheehan left at the end of last week. Those of you who weren't with us, her mother had a stroke. She went out to Los Angeles. And as soon as she left, the rats came into play. We'll talk about that later this morning. We're also going to talk with Michael Penn, singer and songwriter, who's got a new album out called Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947. We want to start out with a little tragic news for those of you who are just waking up this morning. They have not been able to find out a cause of death after San Francisco 49ers guard Thomas Herrien collapsed and died after a football game, an exhibition game, on Saturday night in Denver. He was 6'3", he weighed about 310 pounds. Some people had been speculating all through the sports cycle yesterday that his weight and his size had something to do with his passing. It was not heat stroke like it was with Corey Stringer in Minnesota. It was only 65 degrees, apparently, on the field. And it was really eerie to watch some of the sports shows yesterday with footage of him walking off the field after that game.
Yeah.
It must have been a few minutes later that he collapsed. When an autopsy cannot explain how someone died, when they have to wait for toxicology tests that will take 3 to 6 weeks, there's a real serious problem here.
I remember this happening in my college. A guy dropped dead on the field, and the same situation. They could not tell from the autopsy what happened to that guy. Also a lineman, now that I think about it. And I think when it came back, it was something to do with that energy enhancer, ephedrine.
Right. Well, it's eerily reminiscent of a Baltimore Orioles pitcher. I think his name is Steve Beckler or something like that. And he died as well, and it was a similar to what you're saying, Brendan, that he was taking some kind of a supplement that had ephedrine in it. It was over the counter. He thought that it was okay. It's not like he was taking some kind of illegal steroid that he was injecting. You know, he thought that he was just taking a supplement to help help his workouts, and he dropped dead. And there are just there are a lot of things, and some of these shakes, these giant vats of powder, have a whole bunch of stuff in them. Athletes, you know, have to be especially careful about what they're putting into their bodies. On top of that, when you talk about a guy like that, you know, a lot of these NFL players are almost like superhuman sized.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, your body isn't, you're 6'2 or 6'3, that's tall, but that's not superhuman tall. And if you're 6'2 or 6'3 and you weigh over 300 pounds, I mean, the size and the weight of a lot of these linemen, a lot of their bodies just aren't, your body is not built to support that kind of bulk.
Well, you know, here's a very telling statistic. Apparently, about 20 years ago, you could count the number of 300-pound football players in the NFL on one hand.
Mm.
Now, 20 years down the road, there are over 300 football players in the National Football League, 300 pounds and up. Average sizes of offensive and defensive lines. Over 300 pounds.
What was the turning point for that? Was that like Refrigerator Perry popularizing
Well,
that,
yeah, you know, it's funny. Refrigerator Perry was considered an oddity at that time, and Refrigerator weighed about 320. He was considered a freak. Now, you're considered a freak if you weigh 275 and try to do that same job.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing highlights of the 85 Bears and the William the Refrigerator Perry running with the ball. And when I was a little kid, I remember thinking, oh, my God, this guy is huge.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him now, and I was like, he's not that big
just
at all now.
Just a fat guy.
Yeah. Compared to what you see now.
Now, I got a question for Chris Lopresto, because we're going to change gears real quickly here. Chris Lopresto, if you wanted to prove that the Hudson River was clean, would you jump in it and swim with all your clothes on?
Of course not. No.
Okay. I mean, I'm just asking. Because
is there any money involved?
No, but apparently there was an issue. William Weld, who, by the way, is a good friend of former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and the former governor of Massachusetts, and a guy they inexplicably call Big Red, even though he has blonde hair, is going to run for governor of New York. He's already been governor of Massachusetts. I guess this is the next logical step. Now, the reason why I asked about the Hudson River, Bill Weld jumped in the Charles River in Massachusetts to prove it was clean. He jumped in with all his clothes on.
Huh.
So I'm figuring, you know, one attention, this is New York, you know, you got to get attention somehow. My guess is he'd jump in the Hudson. I'm not sure if he'd ever come back out.
Right. He'd come out with stuff sticking out of him.
Or no clothes, because they all would have dissolved
on exactly.
Him,
right?
I would not take that challenge, Riley, for $1 million, I don't think.
You wouldn't? Why not?
Well, you know, my girlfriend, and actually my fiance, she loves nature, she loves hiking, and she's been trying to get me to kayak in the Hudson River.
That's huge.
Yeah, she's gone kayaking in the Hudson River. Now, she made the mistake of telling me that after kayaking in the Hudson River, because the water splashes up into the kayak, that she had to shower twice and still smell the funny smell on her.
No, I'm not surprised.
Right, but she's still trying to convince me to do it.
Really?
Even though she admitted this to me. So one day we're walking along the Hudson River, and a giant, half-eaten, and I'm talking like 3-foot-long fish carcass floats by on top of the water, and I pointed at that, and I was like, I am not going in there.
Oh, my God. I thought you were going to say a giant 3-foot hero or something.
You know? No, then I would have knocked her over on the way in.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that Weld is running as a Republican and actually seems to have the backing of the Republican machinery here, that guy Steve Mnarik, mm-hmm. who's the state Republican chair. One of the things that indicates is that during this time that George Pataki's been governor, which has been over a decade now, the Republicans have been on cruise control.
Right.
They haven't been able to find him. First, they get Jeanine Pirro, and we're going to get into her a little bit later. We're going to get into some really stupid remarks that somebody who's expecting to challenge her made. And we're going to get in deep inside the Pataki administration, deeper than any of you might want to know.
Right.
Our governor here in New York. But the bottom line here seems to be that Mnarik is picking and choosing who should run for what. And there are a lot of Republicans who deeply resent this here in New York State.
Well, no, also, it seems to me, Riley, that they are they are picking these outsiders.
Yeah.
You know, New York outside, or, you know, outside of the New York political beltway, I guess we'd call it. And that could be that they are willing to offer up sacrificial lambs this go around. I mean, Bill Weld, though, is not a guy we want to take lightly. Many people listening across the country might remember during the last election season, there was a lot of attention paid to Bill Weld when he ran against John Kerry for Senate in 96.
Yeah.
And it was a very contentious race, and Bill Weld almost pulled that off.
Yeah, he almost did. But, you know, almost only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades in politics. And he didn't pull it off. And I don't know that he'll be able to pull it off against Elliot Spitzer, who is right now probably the strongest Democratic gubernatorial candidate in America.
Right.
Who's not already in office. We are going to take a very quick break. We're going to talk about Iraq. And there's a lot to talk about, including some statements made by Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, who, even though some people have branded the guy as a liberal, he's not. Yeah, he's from Nebraska, planet. Right? Yeah. He's a Republican from Nebraska. But he says Iraq is the new Vietnam. We'll find out more next here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
It's just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
It's 21 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation, and sleep is overrated. If it's time for you to get to work at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, I think you need to be up right about now. Dan Pashman is here with us
hey,
in
Mark.
The studio. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm not doing as well as, well, actually, I'm not doing as poorly as the head of the Metropolitan Police in London, Sir Ian Blair.
Yeah.
Soon to be looking for a new job, Ian Blair, if there's right. any justice in the world. Some really troubling facts coming out of London in the wake of the death of Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was killed at the age of 27 by Sir Ian Blair's Metropolitan Police, under circumstances that, as they come to light, reflect very poorly on Sir Ian and his department. He is now trying to defend the department, defend the actions of these officers, and saying, and this really gets me upset, saying, in essence, that they're paying too much attention to his murder, to Menezes' murder, and not enough to the 52 people who were the victims of the July 7th blast. Now, I don't know that the media over in London has stopped paying attention to the victims of the terror attacks, but this was an unnecessary death that was done by his people, all right? And it really is as simple as that. The Deputy Prime Minister, Prescott, who is now in charge of the government because Tony Blair is on vacation, slammed Sir Ian for offering a paltry £15,000, that's about $30,000 US, to the family of Jean-Charles de Menezes, and they sent him the family, apparently, in Brazil, this coldly written letter in English, knowing, apparently, that the family only speaks Portuguese. Now, this is amazing stuff. And, of course, we have seen this kind of problem with law enforcement, various law enforcement agencies here in the U.S., you know, as I think we were talking before about Ruby Ridge, which was certainly not American law enforcement's finest hour, even though, you know, Randy Weaver, the guy involved, was a white separatist. There were still continuing questions about exactly what law enforcement did there. But Sir Ian seems to be... I said this at the end of last week. Maybe he's going to stick this out. He's gotten some unqualified support from some quarters in London, in British government, but I can't imagine he's going to be able to stay.
There really is just no excuse, Mark. You're right. And I mean, the fact that it seems to me like he's digging his own hole deeper and deeper. Each move he makes the situation worse. I mean, for him to say, well, they're thinking too much about Menezes and not enough about the 52 Londoners who were killed in the terrorist attacks is essentially for him to say that killing this innocent Brazilian man was justified.
That's the clear inference in his statements, and that is unacceptable.
Right.
I can't imagine that most Britons feel that that makes logical sense on any level.
And I'll be honest, I was one of the people, we had this debate off the air right when this first happened, when the initial set of facts came out, I was one of the people that defended the actions of the police. Mm. I said, look, this guy came out of the house, was under surveillance, he was wearing a trench coat in the summer, he ran from the cops and kept running when they told him to stop, he jumped a turnstile, he was going to get on a train, if he had a jacket full of bombs, he could have, if he gets in through those doors before they close, it could be another attack. Turns out all those facts were lies.
Yeah, except for the one where he said he left his house.
Right.
That he did.
Right, that's where the truth ended. He wasn't wearing a heavy coat. He didn't run from the cops. He didn't jump a turnstile. He didn't wasn't fleeing from them. So when all those facts come to light, you realize just how wrong their actions were, and there really is no excuse.
No excuse, and it's wrong to the point of being heinous. In terms of his conduct of this entire matter, his thing was to jump up at first when these leaks started taking place. Well, the leaks are the problem. No, you know, someone being killed is the problem. And some people would say that was an act of murder. We won't go that far necessarily, but it certainly seems to have all the hallmarks of an execution. Let's hope that Senator Harry Reid, the minority leader of the Senate, is recovering well. He apparently had a mini stroke. I don't know what a mini stroke is, in fact.
I agree, Mark. I mean, and we do send our best wishes to Senator Reid for a full recovery. But I am a little concerned. As would be the case in any political office, I think that his people are kind of trying to downplay the seriousness of this, and they've thrown out this term to the press that the press has picked up called mini stroke.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we're not doctors. We don't pretend to be doctors. But to me, either you had a stroke or you didn't have a stroke.
Yeah.
And there's no really such thing as a mini stroke.
Well, they call it a transient ischemic attack. That's the medical term for it. But let's hope he recovers from it. That is the main thing. Apparently he's recuperating. He's going to take the rest of the recess to get his ducks in a row, and hopefully he'll feel better and come back to fight the good fight.
That's right.
I hate to use fight the good fight and then jump over to Iraq, because that's not a good fight. It's not working well. The deadline, for those of you who are just getting up this morning, the deadline for the Constitution is today. Now, there are some reports that are saying they may actually get this done today. There are other reports, which, by the way, are juxtaposed by some letter from Saddam Hussein claiming he's a martyr and ready to die. But that's another issue. We'll get to that in a minute. But apparently, the Sunnis have asked the United States not to pressure the Constitution through without their input. They say that the Kurds and the Shiites have been having all these meetings, and they haven't been included in any of them. So there is a problem with this constitution in Iraq. They may have to roll it over, have another delay, which means they'd have to do some kind of special legislation so they don't have to dissolve the National Assembly.
That's right. There have been some serious compromises that we'll talk about later in the show.
Yeah.
So even if it does get passed, there's serious questions as to its validity and how useful it's going to be.
Yeah. And we've got, again, and we talked about this earlier, somebody saying that Iraq sounds like and looks like Vietnam. We'll tell you who next on Morning's Edition at 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation 4 more years. I'm sorry. We'll talk about that in a minute, because some people are going to be somewhere for 4 more years. But first, Kent Jones is with us in studio. Kent, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, Mark Maron has loaned me the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All right, from the Washington Post, Armstrong Bush ride Tour de Crawford.
Ooh.
Armstrong Bush ride Tour de Crawford. And the translation, Armstrong Bush ride Tour de Bull. Bleed. From the Associated Press, GOP senator says Iraq looking like Vietnam. Okay, GOP senator says Iraq looking like Vietnam. Translation, Baghdad, Fallujah, renamed Hanoi, Da Nang. From Reuters, project aims to create 3D television by 2020. Yeah. Ooh. Project aims to create 3D television by 2020. Translation, project aims to create good 3D television by 2055.
Kent Jones, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. Now, I don't know what's going on. Oh, whoa! Nice hands, Chris. I don't know what's going on over in Iraq. I think we should all be concerned about what's going on in Iraq, Dan Pashman.
Yes.
But we're seeing so many conflicting reports. We're seeing, on the one hand, reports that say that there is actually some movement going on in these talks over a new Iraqi constitution, which they have to get done today, or they have to extend the time a second time, and they have to do something to keep the National Assembly alive, because it technically, if they don't get the Constitution done today, the National Assembly would be dissolved.
Right.
All 275 some odd members. The Sunnis, on the other hand, despite all of this rosy news, are saying, look, don't do this. And they've actually appealed directly to the U.S. Don't prod this Constitution forward without us. They are saying that the Shiites and the Kurds have been having all these different meetings and not including them, and they're really upset about it. And see, they got a trump card here. They don't hold that many seats in the National Assembly. But when the time comes to ratify this Constitution, the way the Iraqi rules are being drawn, they can actually get it voted down because they control a certain number of provinces. I believe they control four, and it only takes three of Iraq's provinces to vote against the Constitution for it to be scuttled. But the big news, Dan, is out of D.C. Chuck Hagel.
You know, Mark, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to tack on one thing to the discussion of the Constitution
before
we move on, is that we just have news coming in now that that Iraq's a major meeting about the Constitution has been delayed. Iraq's ethnic and religious factions still not able to work it out. They've delayed a meeting in their final effort to hammer out the draft of this new Constitution before today's deadline. The meeting was originally planned for this morning, so it would have already happened or be happening right now, Iraq time. It's now been postponed until 7 p.m. because of differences among these different groups. So already some bad news in terms of the possibility of them coming to an agreement today. We already see meetings being delayed and pushed back. It's certainly not looking promising.
No, and so much for progress on the Constitution,
right,
which is the headline we just had an hour ago. By the way, this information we're getting is courtesy of Al Jazeera. I know many people hate Al Jazeera. I'm not sure whether it's justified or not, but they are the ones with this news. And, of course, there was 8 Iraqi police commandos were killed and 4 wounded in a car bomb explosion late Sunday night as well, in Iraq. So the violence is continuing. But Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican of Nebraska, will never be confused with Hillary Clinton, will never be confused with the late Paul Wellstone, will never be confused with John Corzine of New Jersey. He is a relatively conservative guy. But you know what? Chuck Hagel, who, by the way, received 2 Purple Hearts and other military honors for his service in Vietnam, says to him, Iraq is starting to look a lot like Vietnam. And I think we have a piece of him saying this. I think this was on This Week on ABC.
Now we are locked into a bogged down problem, not unsimilar, dissimilar to where we were in Vietnam.
Now, you know, what's interesting about this is that Senator Hagel has been one of those people who has long advocated, at least at the beginning of the conflict, sending 2 to 3 times as many troops, which is the Shinseki model. Send, 300,000, 400,000 troops. That way you can seal the border between Iraq and Syria and prevent fighters from coming in and continuing to nurture this insurgency. Of course, he was ignored then. And now he says that a stronger military presence by the U.S. is not the way to go today. It's an incredible situation that Chuck Hagel is commenting on. And, you know, other people are talking about, you know, patience. We need to have more. Lindsey Graham, for example, senator from South Carolina. We need to be patient. Well, you know, the American people have been patient on this for an awfully long time.
They really have, Mark. I mean, you know, I was just thinking about today, you know, we also have a story coming out that over the weekend, one of the top generals in Iraq, General Shoemaker, predicted or said that the army is planning for 4 more years in Iraq. And what you just said and that story made me think back to the period of time right before we went into Iraq and right after we went into Iraq. I got two news headlines that seem to have been completely forgotten by most people, but you'll remember them as soon as you hear them. Remember Shock and Awe?
Oh, yeah.
Remember Shock and Awe? Remember January 03, 3 months before the invasion, we heard how we were going to go in there and it was going to be shock and awe. We were going to run over, and it was going to be, no question, this was going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, rose petals right. on the streets right. of Baghdad. Did not happen.
It did not happen. And then the other story, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
So we had shock and awe predicted beforehand. We had mission accomplished 2 months after the invasion. Now we find out that we could be looking at 4 more years at 100,000 plus troops in Iraq.
And the watchword now is patience. And see, what this means in really stark terms is that those of you who have been looking for your kids or your nieces or your nephews or your grandkids to come home from Iraq, you may have to wait a little bit longer. This means that those troop deployments that were supposed to have been 12 months will now stretch out to 18 months. That's what's going on now in Iraq. And in fact, you're talking very soon about having the 101st Airborne, which is based, I believe, in North Carolina, and the 4th Infantry Division, which is based in Fort Hood, Texas, called up again. Now, they've both been deployed for a year each previous to this. And it looks like next year, if these troop levels remain the same, the 101st Airborne and the 4th Infantry Division will be called back to Iraq. So what we see going on here, and by the way, all of this is playing into this pressure that the U.S. is applying behind the scenes to get that Iraqi constitution done. Because I think the Bush administration believes that if they can get the constitution done, they can start pulling back at least on some troops, maybe get people out when they thought they were coming out to begin with.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mark. That's exactly what their thought is. But frankly, I think it's bogus. We have seen time and time again with this Iraq war, these fake deadlines. And they keep saying, oh, well, I know it looks bad now, but after we get to this point coming up, it'll start to get better. First, we heard of the fall of Baghdad. Well, now yep. now we won. We heard the elections in January were going to be a turning point.
Yep.
We heard that this constitution, once again, they told us is going to be the next turning point. Oh, we're just going to get the constitution ratified. It is BS. Okay, they keep creating a new deadline to look forward to. So it's kind of like when you're waiting in line at Disney World and they break up the line into all different parts. So you think you're at the end,
yeah.
and then you get to that point and all of a sudden a curtain opens and there's another 1,000 people in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the situation that we're in here in Iraq. And it's very reminiscent, as Chuck Hagel said, of what happened in Vietnam. Everyone, the leaders keep saying, well, the end is right around the corner, and you get around the corner, and you still have a long way to go.
Chuck Hagel says the longer U.S. troops stay in Iraq, the further destabilization will occur. He says stay the course is not a policy. Now, that flies directly in the face of the Bush administration. We should pay attention to the fact that Chuck Hagel is one of those contemplating a run for president in 2008.
Yes.
And, you know, if this situation continues, and remember that, you know, the generals that are talking about 4 more years are talking about through 2009, not 2008.
Right.
So if Chuck Hagel decides to run for president, remember we were talking at the end of last week that there may be somebody running for president on the Republican side who will say, get the troops out now? I think we may have found him.
It's absolutely right, Mark. And I have a sinking feeling that whoever wins the presidency in 2008 is going to inherit the Iraq war.
Yeah. And see, there's another side to this, and we're going to get into this a little bit later when we talk about the rats coming after Cindy Sheehan left Camp Casey to go out to California to tend to her mother, because supporting the troops does not necessarily mean supporting this president, does not necessarily mean supporting this policy. Chuck Hagel is no radical, but he does not support this policy because he does not think, and he's an ex-military guy, he does not think the policy is effective. He does not think the policy will win. He thinks more American soldiers' lives will be lost if we continue down the road we're going. And I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be true.
I agree, Mark. I'd be curious what you think. I've gone back and forth on the issue. You know, I'm not yet willing to go as far as some people to say bring the troops home right now. I recognize that we've created a huge disaster there, but to pick up and leave right at this moment today would probably make things a lot worse. But I felt more strongly of that opinion a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And more I'm starting to think that the place is screwed either way. And
true, but I can tell you one way we could start to at least erase part of the stain
yeah.
that we have left on the Middle East by our invasion of Iraq. And that is to bring the nations of the world together whether it be in the United Nations, NATO, or under whatever circumstance, bring these countries together and talk about a consensus plan for dealing with Iraq. Not an American plan, not a unilateral plan, but a consensus plan that will involve U.S. troops. It's going to have to involve some U.S. troop presence. And that is directly, the fault for that can be laid, in my judgment, directly at the feet of this president. You cannot ignore that simple fact. So what has to happen, I think, is that America has to show the world that we are not or no longer prepared to just go it alone no matter what anybody else thinks in the Middle East. I think we really do have to say, hey, we are going to act on a consensus basis from here on out. We are going to find a way to do this. We are going to have to keep some troops there. We do not want to necessarily be the, you know, the front lines, you know, trying to quell this insurgency. But let's do what we can. The reason why a lot of these countries are not backing America now, even in the training of Iraqi troops, is because we went in unilaterally in the first place. And that's a very difficult thing to mend. But mend it, we must.
Yes.
Things are getting from bad to worse in Afghanistan, too. You know, more people have died this year, and more American troops have died in Afghanistan this year than any year since we invaded that country back in 01. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that next. It's 46 past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Lawton Smalls, Morning's Edition's Planet Bush Bureau Chief. You know why I'm praying for you? Because you're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week, Morning Sedition Radio Theater presents The L Word with Mark Maron as Jenny, Mark Riley as Dana, and a special surprise guest star.
Haven't you ever been to a bar before?
Not a woman's bar. By myself? This is like something out of the 1950s. It's so butch and femme.
Well, it's the oldest lesbian bar in L.A. Actually, it probably hasn't changed since the 1950s. But really, it's no different than any other club. You know, I mean, you have a few drinks, you talk to a few people you have nothing in common with, and you realize how unlikely it is you'll ever meet anyone who's right for you again.
Wow. Who's that woman?
I don't know, but she's coming over.
Excuse me, ladies. I just moved into town from Chicago, and I'm still meeting people out here. Can I buy either of you gals a fuzzy navel?
Don't you think you're being a little forward? We don't even know your name.
I'm Jane Gilman.
This has been The L Word on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Lord have mercy. I don't know if we'll ever top that one. And our good friend Jane Gilman, who I guess now is known as News Mommy. I don't know. We'll see. We'll talk to him a little later on. But, you know, we've been talking about Iraq for the last little while, and we need to talk a bit about Afghanistan. Four U.S. troops killed there on Sunday. 13 have been killed during the month of August alone. 65 Americans have been killed there this year. And, of course, there are legislative elections coming up on September 18th, and that is what people fear is the cause of escalating violence. Now, you know, within a certain context, certainly you're going to expect some level of violence as this goes forward. But the question of whether or not invading Afghanistan, which, unlike Iraq, a lot of Americans supported, at least initially, the invasion of Afghanistan. But do these troop casualties indicate to people that the mission there is in as bad a shape as it is in Iraq?
I don't think, Mark, that it's as bad as in Iraq. But I think what I would say is that it indicates to people is that the job in Afghanistan isn't finished yet. And
nope.
That we were so premature in turning our attention to Iraq that we did not finish the job in Afghanistan. We know now that the U.S. military began pulling troops out of Afghanistan to direct our attentions to Iraq at a very, very early stage after the defeat of the Taliban. Excuse me. And we really need to remember Afghanistan has become the forgotten war. And
yeah.
And that job. I'm still in favor of what we're doing in Afghanistan. I think we had to go in there. We had to do what we did, but we had to do it right. And the decision to go into Iraq has severely hampered the effort in Afghanistan.
That it has. And, of course, what we're seeing, and this is the eerie similarity between Iraq and Afghanistan. Two different countries obviously border these places. In Iraq's case, it's Syria. In Afghanistan's case, it shares a large border with Pakistan. But the flow of insurgents into both countries,
yes,
as a result of porous borders, is a problem that American troops are facing in both places. Now, the Afghan. Now, remember that Pakistan is supposed to be our ally, and we occupy Afghanistan. And not only are fighters coming into Afghanistan from Pakistan, and certainly the Afghan government admits to this, but Osama bin Laden is hidden out in there somewhere. The guy that Bush said we were going to bring to justice, dead or alive, is in this same area. And essentially thumbing his nose at the United States, thumbing his nose specifically at George W. Bush. And again, I believe that's in part due to the fact that Bush treated this as a military problem and not a law enforcement intelligence problem. And that speaks to the fact that American intelligence and American law enforcement have to learn a better way of working together. Now, they are precluded by law from working together on certain issues, certainly in terms of domestic surveillance. I wouldn't want to change a thing about that.
Right.
But when it comes to sharing intelligence about people who we believe have harmed this country, and certainly when it comes to bin Laden, everyone believes that this is the guy behind the attacks on the World Trade Center, the attacks on the Pentagon, the attack on that flight that ended up in Pennsylvania, then he needs to be brought to justice, and our resources from the beginning, from 01, should have been focused on bringing this man to justice. Now, there's been a lot of back and forth about whether, you know, we had a chance to get him at Tora Bora, we didn't get him, blah, 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 blah. Fine. The bottom line is, why isn't America at this point prepared to expend serious resources to bring this man to justice? Because, see, I really believe that at a point, you will begin to stop the flow of insurgents into Afghanistan if you can get Osama bin Laden and put him out of commission.
I think that's a great point, Mark. And, you know, one thing I want to mention quickly relating to that, and we'll get into later as well, you know, you talk about bringing terrorists down and the policies that we've undertaken. Well, torture has been one of our accepted policies.
Absolutely.
There. And we have some very disturbing news that I'm extremely angry about, that a military jury has spared an Army reservist jail time. All right. The military prosecutors wanted 10 years for this guy. They gave him no jail time at all for what I consider to be the most heinous, most egregious of all the horrible stories that have come out of all the prisons. They killed this Afghani taxi driver, even though they didn't think he had done anything wrong. They didn't think he had any information. They considered him innocent, and yet they still beat him to death over a period of 4 days, to the point that the medical examiner said that his body was, quote-unquote, falling apart.
This is literally, literally beaten to a pulp. The description of this would sicken you, so we're not going to go too deep into it because I know a lot of you are getting ready to eat your breakfast this morning. But believe me, this is something that should turn your stomach, and it should be something that Americans should be aware of and prepared to stop. In our next hour, we're going to talk about why actors who play cops in New York might be in danger of getting arrested. We're also going to talk about Bill Clinton's plans to save the world with Jennifer Senior from New York Magazine, all coming up here on Air America Radio. Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Welcome to BET. It's 6 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. When do I get my well-deserved vacation?
Next week, buddy. Next week.
Yeah, but he's off next week, too. What is it? It was 2-1 or something? What's going on?
I thought you went to Disney World a couple months ago, Riley.
That wasn't a whole week. Anyway, Mark Maron is in Hawaii. He's flying over the lip of a volcano as we speak. And, Misha, his wife gets him into some really tough fixes. Because I'll tell you what, you couldn't pay me to get in a helicopter with no doors and fly over some, hole in the ground. But, hey, that's me. I quibble.
Why is it important that it doesn't have doors? Why does that make it more fun?
No, it makes it more dangerous to me.
So it just gives you more of a little...
It's frisson? Right, it's one and the same. It makes it more dangerous and thus more fun.
All right. Guys are weird.
Oh, by the way, we didn't introduce the other... My name is Mark Riley. Dan Patchman's over there.
Hi.
And over here is the great Rachel Maddow herself.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning.
Happy
How you
doing? To be here. I'm great. You're doing a great job. I like listening to you guys.
Well, we're trying.
Here.
We're
yeah.
trying.
Real good.
Now, there's some new words coming out. We talked about Afghanistan in the last hour. And we're talking about this reservist, Willie Brand, who was essentially slapped on the wrist for murdering a guy. I mean, at least that's the way it seems.
Right.
But, the prosecutors only wanted 10 years for the guy anyway.
Well, yeah, and 10 years is even a little bit light for this guy, frankly, Riley. Yeah, but I just want to give a quick rundown of what they did to this guy, and it's a little bit graphic, but I feel like it needs to be said. All right, when this guy, his name is Dilawar, he's only 22 years old.
And cab driver.
As a cab driver. When he arrived in the interrogation room, his legs were bouncing uncontrollably in the plastic chair, and his hands were numb because he had been chained by the wrists to the top of his cell for the previous 4 days.
Right.
A guard tried to force the young man to his knees, but his legs, which had been pummeled by guards for several days, could no longer bend. When he was finally sent back to his cell, the guards chained him back to the ceiling. Several hours later, he was found dead. The medical examiner who performed the man's autopsy would later say that his muscles were, quote, falling apart. Here's the real clincher, and this is what makes this the most egregious of any of these torture stories, in my opinion. It would be many months before Army investigators learned a final horrific detail. Most of the interrogators had believed Mr. Dilawar was an innocent man who simply drove his taxi past the American base at the wrong time. Now, I think one of the biggest reasons to me why this torture thing has not received the attention and the concern that it deserves by many of the people in America is that I think to a lot of them, their attitude is, well, these guys are terrorists. They do the same thing to us. So torturing them is okay. They deserve it. Don't you remember 9/11?
I think people think that, this is the way that these people treat each other. And this is the way that, you would think the Afghan police would be any better. We're the civilized people here, and we just need to be able to play dirty in order to get across to these people. Well, you know what? Let's say that's true. Let's say you assume that about the world. Why is the United States military, why is the United States of America saying that we need to do those things in order to have our way in the world? Why do we need to sink to that level in order to do it? And then you get these cases where these guys are innocent.
Yeah, and, this guy was a PFC. Responsibility for this man's death and another Afghani man's death in custody like this
right.
has to go higher up the food chain than just Willie Brand.
That's right.
There are other people who supervise Willie Brand
yeah.
who ought to be called to account. They didn't put this guy in some soundproof room out of everyone's sight to do this kind of torture. And by the way, if you want to take it to its logical conclusion, we might look down to Washington and our Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, who said that the Bush administration was perfectly right in dancing around the Geneva Conventions, which specifically preclude and prohibit this kind of nonsense.
The thing that amazes me, too, is that the idea of knee strikes, which is what they were doing to this guy
right.
over a period of days, using their own legs, using their knees to attack this guy's limbs over and over and over again. That's not something that you learn hazing in football in high school.
Right. No.
This is something that's taught. This is a deliberate strategy. And that's the thing that keeps me up at night and freaks me out about the torture stuff, is because somebody's teaching U.S. military personnel to do this.
Yeah.
You see them piling up naked bodies. You see the sexual humiliation. You see the use of women prisoners in a way that is almost as debasing to the women prisoners as it is to the people who are being tortured. You see the knee strikes. You see the use of unmuzzled dogs. And it's in Guantanamo, and it's in Iraq, and it's at Bagram, and it's all over the world. And it's very similar things happening everywhere. And it is a deliberate policy that's being taught.
That's yes. right, and it's certainly no mistake that I know at least I forget what his title is, but Jeffrey Miller,
that's right.
who was in Guantanamo, and they said that he was doing so great in Gitmo
yeah.
that they sent him off to Abu Ghraib, and it was certainly no accident that a couple months after he arrived in Abu Ghraib, we saw the same allegations coming forward. So this was ordered from on high, and it was passed down. But especially with this Dilawar guy, this Afghani, the young man, 22 years old. Because he was innocent. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was driving his cab down the street. This is one of the guys that we're supposedly trying to save.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. We have a wrong place, wrong time scenario in Afghanistan. We got a wrong place, wrong time scenario in London. And people are paying for this with their lives, and people are the people responsible trying to skate. They're trying to walk away from this like, well, we should pay more attention to the 52 people who were killed by the suicide bombers in London. We shouldn't pay as much attention to this guy. Wait a minute. We're comparing apples and oranges here. The 52 who were killed by acts of terror, and they have to be, people have to be held responsible, obviously. But if you're going to hold people responsible for that, then you have to hold people responsible for the death of this innocent, and the innocent was killed by police. That is an established fact. We're talking now about Sir Ian Blair, the head of the Metropolitan Police in London, who has been dancing as if he was in some kind of marathon around the issue of who takes responsibility for the death of Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was a Brazilian electrician, an innocent man whose story was completely twisted by the police department to make it sound as if he was somehow a suicide bomber or a terrorist. And now Sir Ian says, well, I didn't know until 24 hours after he died that there was some question. And, you know, there are published reports that say his underlings were discussing the fact that they had shot the wrong man during that same period. So, in other words, Sir Ian's people knew, but he didn't. Somebody didn't want to wake him up or something. I don't know exactly what the problem was, but he needs to pay. He needs to step. An honorable person would have stepped down by now. As far as I'm concerned.
The situation with that shoot-to-kill policy, too, is that, I mean, you know, Mark, the British police don't generally carry guns,
yes.
Right? The rate of gun violence in Britain, not so high.
Yep.
The police don't see a need to have guns in order to combat crime in Britain. And they've got this shoot-to-kill policy now. And so they've got more armed police. They've got a shoot-to-kill policy. And, yeah, you need to be able to answer for when these things go wrong. But what's pushing them to have the shoot-to-kill policy?
Yeah,
what's pushing them in this direction? I mean, the whole U.S. war on terror partnership thing here, where are they learning this stuff from?
Yeah, absolutely. And see, the British public realizes this. That's why they are so vehemently against the alliance that was made between Tony Blair and George W. Bush. Quick other story, though, Rachel, because you're here, and I know you spent, you're from Massachusetts, right? You live in Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's right.
Did Bill Weld follow you here?
Oh, my God.
Former governor of Massachusetts.
I am trying to shake that skunk if I can. Moderate schmoderate. I cannot believe this guy. This idea that you have to, in order to be a Republican who is competitive in Bush's Republican Party, you have to be a monster in terms of civil rights issues.
Right.
And so Bill Weld, who used to be a moderate Republican, he didn't used to be a radical liberal Republican, he used to just be a moderate Republican. But now the fact that he has in the past supported gay rights, now that has come back and bit him and made him unqualified to be the governor of New York State in the eyes of the Republican Party. They're making him backtrack on all of his previous support for gay rights so he can be the governor of New York. Because that's what's happened to the Republican Party. You can't be a candidate of national stature and like gay people anymore. Republicans won't let you do it.
But you know what? He's going to lose. if he runs there in New York, he is going to lose. Elliot Spitzer, I believe, will embarrass him next year if Weld ends up being the one that gets the nomination.
No matter who the Republicans run, Elliot Spitzer is going to embarrass them. And so let it be Bill Weld, because somebody who takes their principles like that and throws them under the bus at the behest of Karl Rove, you ought to be out of it. You ought to be embarrassed. You ought to have your hat handed to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole thing about jumping in the Charles River was a little strange to begin with. I'm waiting, you know, because we got plenty of pier space over here on the west side of Manhattan. He can jump in the Hudson or the East River anytime he so chooses. You know, Cindy Sheehan has gone back out to Los Angeles. And Rachel, this is one of those stories that just gets my goat to no end.
Mm.
Here is a woman who has, become an international symbol of peace.
Yeah.
All right. She's not talking about making, well, she wants an explanation from George W. Bush as to why her son died. She went to Los Angeles, and now the minute she leaves, what happens? Bush's people suddenly turn up with counter-protests all over the place.
That's right.
This, to me, just shows what complete and total cowards these people are.
Hmm.
I mean, Cindy Sheehan, to me, is such an honorable representation of the anti-war movement, and these people do not have the nads to confront her. And, of course, it makes perfect sense because they take their example from their president, who also does not have the nads to confront her. So they wait for her to leave, and like the spineless bastards that they are, then they move in with their fake imitation BS camp, okay, which is so offensive. I mean, just like the guy who under cover of night drove his pickup truck through the camp to run over the crosses, these people are consumed with cowardice and have no ability to confront the reality of what's happening in Iraq or the reality of Cindy Sheehan. And so Bush flees to Idaho, and while his goons come out under cover of night to run over crosses or wait till Cindy Sheehan is left to set up their camp, these people are cowards. And if they had won 1/100th the courage of Cindy Sheehan, they'd all be heading back home immediately.
As they say in the Bronx, you got no heart. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
We are going to take a very quick break. And when we... Oh, no. Next. Actors who play cops in New York City are in danger of being arrested even if they're not wearing their uniforms. We'll tell you why, and we'll tell you how Bill Clinton plans to take over the world next on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Dar Williams. After a long night of electric guitar solos, pyrotechnics, trashed hotel rooms, and bad eating, I listen to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. I'm flying solo, but with my homies here for the entire week's time.
Riley?
Yes, yes, sir.
Sorry to bother you, but this is going to be weird. That threatening guy from Mark, he's on the line. What do we do?
What the hell? I'll tell him Mark's not here. Hello, stalker guy. Are you there? Hello? Oh, I guess he's not there. I'm not sure.
I only talked to Mark Maron. Sorry, Mark Riley.
Well, he's not here, man. Ah, I see. There seems to be some problem.
What are you talking about, Mark Riley?
Mark's on vacation. He won't be here for the next 2 whole weeks.
What the? This is just unacceptable. Jeez, I told Mark I needed a schedule.
Yeah, people aren't usually that accommodating with their stalkers. You're just going to have to wait it out.
Tell me where he is, Mark Riley.
I can't do that.
You don't want to get on my bad side, Mark Riley.
Well, no, I really don't, but Mark will be back soon, and you can just stalk him then, okay?
What am I supposed to do until then? Okay, wait a minute. You're making me mad, Mark Riley, and I think I like it.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh was right, pal. Looks like I'm your worst nightmare now.
Oh, crap.
That's right, Mark Riley. A world of crap. Now I'm just going to need to get your home address, phone numbers, route you take to work, family name, stuff like that.
Okay, I'm hanging up about now.
I'll be listening to you, Mark Riley. Okay, talk to you tomorrow. Bye. Yeah, I think this is going to work out, you bastard.
Wow. Now I got to deal with this guy.
Right? I'm a little worried about you now, Riley.
Oh, Lord, Lord. Listen, if you're just waking up and you don't want and the stalker kind of got you off your game a little bit, we do want you to know the following. Thomas Herrien had an autopsy done, the defensive lineman for the San Francisco 49ers who collapsed and died after a football game Saturday night. They don't know what killed him. They won't know for another 3 to 6 weeks when toxicological work is done on his body. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Army is planning for 4 more years in Iraq. They say that's a worst-case scenario, but everything about Iraq has been a worst-case scenario. So 09 looks like the earliest time when troops are going to be coming home.
Yeah, seriously, it's pretty disturbing. I mean, especially seeing as we were told this was going to be a cakewalk, we were promised shock and awe. We had mission accomplished, declared 2 months afterwards after we invaded, and now we're being told patience, patience, patience. 4 more years of this disaster, and I just don't know how much more our military can take, how much more our troops can take, let alone how much more the American people can take.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, we also are looking at some other stories in the news, including the rather strange report coming out of New York that actors, people who work in various theatrical and film productions in New York City, can risk arrest if they are walking around with a New York City police uniform on, and they don't have to wear it. It can be in a garment bag. Because of the new search policy in the subway system, you can get arrested for wearing or carrying a New York City Police Department uniform. The Screen Actors Guild, SAG, has sent out a warning to its members. not to get caught like this.
I guess I'm not going to be a cop for Halloween, huh?
That's like every working actor in New York. You know how many actors, the only way they can pay the bills is by getting spots on Law & Order? You know, they get unpaying theater gigs for like, you know, 11 months out of the year, and they get that one spot on Law & Order where they're like cop number three. Yeah. Now you're going to jail.
Now you're going to jail for it. And, of course, there are other you know, theatrical productions,
strippers.
Strippers.
Male strippers. They have, you know, police garments.
What about that guy from The Village People? He's screwed.
Well, he really is screwed. That guy's gone to jail several times.
I'll tell you what. I think they're going to have to wear some Minneapolis Police Department action or something, because it is a very, very bizarre story. And hopefully people won't get... I wonder how many people got locked up for other kinds of contraband since they started this supposedly random search process.
I don't know. But Brendan, isn't your fiancée's been on Law & Order a couple times. Has she ever played a cop?
No, she never played a cop on television. She's played the receptionist in this, so I think they're still safe. But
right,
the first receptionist there.
If they start confiscating receptionist outfits, you're gonna be in real trouble.
Exactly. Or you know, the first receptionist related terrorist incident, then I'm gonna tell her to watch out when she's on the subway.
Oh, Lord, this is unbelievable. Also, we want to let you know some late breaking news, and that is that the constitutional talks that were scheduled to start in Iraq early this morning have been put off until, I believe, about 7 o'clock Iraq time.
Tonight.
Which is about 11 o'clock here.
Right.
I don't think they're going to be able to get that job done.
It's not looking good, Mark. It's not looking good. But whether or not they get it done, I don't think it's going to have a significant impact on the amount of violence we're seeing there.
Yep. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the good old days, about Bill Clinton and some new plans he has with New York Magazine contributor Jennifer Senior. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio, 27 past the hour.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. Our next live broadcast will be our biggest ever. We'll be at the New School on Friday, September 9th. We'll have former Senator Bob Kerrey and The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert. That's Friday, September 9th at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues right here in New York City from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. Our next guest is a contributing writer for New York Magazine. She just got back from a whirlwind trip to Africa with former President Bill Clinton. Her article about that trip is entitled "The Candidate Bill Clinton is Still Running, But for What," it appears in the current issue of New York Magazine. Joining us by phone from the People's Republic of Brooklyn, New York, is Ms. Jennifer Senior. Good morning, Jennifer. How you doing? Hello? Oh, I guess she's not with us. We will get to Jennifer Senior. How do they say in Spanish radio? Pero un momentito. She did travel with Bill Clinton to Africa, and she talks a lot in this piece about what his future plans are. Bill Clinton was a relatively young guy when he left the White House, and has a lot of time on his hands. He relives, according to Jennifer Senior's piece, some of his triumphs and tragedies during his 8 years as president. But he also talks about a lot of the work that he is doing now. Jennifer Senior, are you with us?
Uh-huh.
Good morning. Can you hear us? Oh, it seems like we got a little bit of a phone problem this morning. I think she was there, but we seem to have a little bit of difficulty getting her on the air. So we will try and rectify that little problem, and we'll talk about another little problem that is being, or at least attempted to be rectified, and that is Iraq. And we've been talking about this for the better part of the morning. It looks as though, according to Al Jazeera, that the constitutional talks that were scheduled for this morning, Baghdad time, have been pushed back because they just can't come to an agreement. There are three major players in this drafting of an Iraqi constitution. For those of you who are not fully aware, there are the Shiites, there are the Kurds, and there are the Sunnis. The Sunnis, of course, were the dominant power in Iraq, despite representing only 20% of the population. Many of them boycotted the January elections, and now perhaps that boycott is coming back to haunt. They say that the Shiites and the Kurds have been holding meetings and that they have not at this point, included the Sunnis in many of those meetings in terms of drafting a new constitution. And the Sunnis, the Sunni beef with the constitution is over, the central beef is over the issue of federalism. That is, granting each group in Iraq a degree of autonomy. The Kurds, by the way, are prepared to walk away from the table if they do not get that kind of autonomy that federalism would in fact bring. And the Shia, being 60% of the population, apparently are prepared to side with the Kurds. There is the, unspoken caveat here that it is Sunnis who make up a good part of the Iraqi insurgency, a very, very deadly insurgency up until now, Dan Pashman.
It's true, Mark. And, you know, I think another thing that has gone relatively unreported in the coverage of this constitution is just how involved the Bush administration and the U.S. government has been in terms of meddling and in terms of trying to orchestrate the writing of this constitution, because they are desperate for a political victory in this constitution. They cannot stomach more delays. But just, I think even worse than more delays would be a constitution that comes out and declares them, declares Iraq to be the Islamic State of Iraq, where women have no rights.
Yeah.
Where if you're not an Islamic extremist, you better watch your butt, where there is no religious freedom. And, you know, we supposedly went into Iraq to establish a democracy. Well, we got news today that the Bush administration has backtracked off of some of its demands for the constitution that it was holding to up until the weekend. And now they're saying that they're going to allow a larger Islamic influence in the constitution, in the government of Iraq. And it's looking more and more like, instead of establishing a democracy in the Middle East, which was Bush's third explanation for why we went in there, yeah, the first two turned out to not be true. It turns out that instead of establishing a democracy in the Middle East, we may be on the verge of establishing another Islamic fundamentalist state right along with Iran and Syria, that we need to worry about as instead of being an isolated non-threat to America, which is what Iraq was, we have a direct threat to our safety and security that is going to be working hand-in-hand with Iran and other nations that we know are bent on our destruction.
The Bush administration was warned about this a while ago.
Yes.
That one of the possible outcomes of a democratic Iraq would be a democratically elected group of people who would then install an Islamic State. They knew this.
Right.
They were told this. Yet they plowed ahead anyway. And now they have actually backed off their, I guess they thought that their own suasion would be enough to try, you know, to affect the Iraqis so they wouldn't do this. And now it is apparent that that is very much a possibility. Hopefully we'll be getting to Jennifer Senior. I thought she might be there for a minute. But,
right. I would just add, Mark, you're 100% right. But if this ends up becoming an extremist Islamic state, if that is what we get out of this invasion of Iraq, it is a failure of monumental and catastrophic proportions. That is the exact opposite of what we went in there to do. That is the exact opposite of what we want to come out of this situation. And if there is any question, which there really shouldn't be, that our invasion of Iraq has made things worse and put us in greater danger, that would really be the final linchpin.
Well, yeah, and apparently the U.S. ambassador, who, by the way, last week was running around saying, oh, they're going to get it done by last Monday, which obviously they did not
right.
do. We're talking about Zalmay Khalilzad. He is now proposing that Islam be named a primary source and supported a wording in the Iraqi constitution that would give clerics authority in civil matters such as divorce, marriage, and inheritance. Now, you know what that means.
Right.
That means women, under what he just said was okay, would get shafted, because divorce, under Islamic law, would probably be the sole province of men. In other words, women could not sue for divorce.
Right.
The question of who inherits in a family. Well, you have a large family. So let's say there's 13 women and one guy in this family. Well, under certain Islamic, not all Islamic law, because I don't want to misspeak about what Islamic law is, but under Islamic law in other countries, the women would be effectively disinherited.
Right.
All right. Under law, not under any fiat given by the by the individual in the family, by the law. So when the U.S. is signing off on this, again, in its haste to try and bring something positive out of what's going on in Iraq, understand, Americans, who is going to get the short end of the stick in this? It's going to be Iraqi women who have been, up until now, you know, pushing very hard to get some kind of rights guaranteed in the new Iraqi constitution.
It's true, and I'll tell you right now that when this constitution gets passed, and it will get passed, not today, I'll go ahead and predict that right now, they're not going to make today's deadline.
No.
But it will get passed eventually, but I'm quite confident in saying that there are going to be some serious compromises in terms of the ideals of democracy and freedom that we're supposedly bringing to Iraq. There are going to be some serious compromises that are going to need to be made to get this constitution passed. But when it does get passed, Mark, I think that Bush and the neocons are going to hold it up and say, ta-da, look, we did it. Iraq is free. The people have, you know, we brought democracy to Iraq. But when you start reading the fine print of that constitution, it's going to be a very different proposition entirely.
But you know what? People don't read the fine print. And that's what the Bush administration is counting on, that people will not read the fine print, that they will just believe him when he gets on television a couple of weeks from now. So, we've fixed everything.
Right.
And, you know, he's going to come very close to saying that, even though it is obvious to the casual observer that stuff hasn't been fixed. We've been doing this now for, what, almost 18 months?
Right.
How many people have we talked to from Iraq, objective reporters from Iraq, who have told us time and time and time again that we were slip-sliding into a quagmire? And now we've got Chuck Hagel, senator from Nebraska, Republican senator from Nebraska, saying that Iraq looks a lot to him like the Vietnam he got two Purple Hearts fighting in.
Right.
This is a very, very important development, and it means that the once rock-solid support of the Bush administration among congressional Republicans is starting to erode. We're going to take a break, come back. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to Jennifer Senior, but we're also going to start talking about our president, who has decided to take today to hopscotch from Crawford to Salt Lake City, where the mayor is apparently getting ready to protest his appearance.
Right, and we also have the morning remembrance with
Mort Mortensen coming up. That's right. And we're going to talk a little bit about his Idaho trip, because that could have the potential of being ugly as well. It's
right.
43 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Attention, mis hermanos and mis hermanas. This is Pendejo.
¡Viva la revolución!
You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And as promised, our next guest is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. Her article about her trip to Africa with former President Bill Clinton is entitled The Candidate. Bill Clinton is still running, but for what? A pleasure to welcome to our microphones via telephone from Brooklyn, Ms. Jennifer Senior. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. I'm glad we finally hooked up.
Yeah, so me too. That was quite a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Did we ever do New York One together?
Yes,
we did.
We did.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you were lovely.
You too. Now,
I didn't know much, but you were lovely.
Now, you went with Bill Clinton to Africa, and you know he is a relatively young former president.
Oh, yeah.
How did that reflect in terms of your experience with him as he went through the continent?
That it was exhausting. I mean, it was exhausting watching him, and that he was up before all of us, and he went to sleep at about 4 in the morning and sometimes 5 in the morning. And there was one particular evening where he described, or morning, I guess, when he described to me in very amusing detail every single, you know, made-for-TV movie that he'd caught because he couldn't fall asleep, you know, one involving, like, the smuggling of yellow cake. I mean, the guy in, like a metabolic, you know, anomaly. I mean, he's just absurd.
Mm. Talk about the Clinton Global Initiative. I think it may be better known outside the states than inside.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's exactly right. If you polled, 100 New Yorkers, I don't think they'd have a clue, you know, maybe 3. What is it? It is this giant get-together. It's a lot like Davos. It's a lot like the Renaissance Weekend. It's like the Aspen Ideas Festival. But the difference that Clinton hopes will be that it's going to be lots of world leaders, Tony Blair, you know, Shimon Peres, I can't, you know, King Hussein. I'm not thinking of all of them, but I mean, zillions of them. You know, Sonia Gandhi, and lots of business types like Rupert Murdoch and Dick Parsons. And the idea is that at the end, they will come out having pledged to do something about bettering the world, whether it's, you know, alleviating poverty or improving the environment or religious reconciliation. So it's going to be hopefully one of these big high-end policy clam bakes, but that actually has at the end some kind of, you know, goal to do better things.
Now, it's interesting because Bill Clinton, on a certain level, must be looking at the George Bush presidency and saying, oh, my God, I could have done this so much better. Does he? Did you ever get that sense?
If he does, he's not letting on. He really isn't. And, you know, also, the things that make you president make, you know, actually make you slightly not human in a sense. I mean, in some ways, he's definitely human. But, it's hard to detect the same kind I'm trying to think of how to answer that question. I mean, for example, I asked him once, you know, were you depressed, you know, for the first few months? And it was like the question didn't even compute, you know. I mean, I just keep thinking about the great deal of moping I would do if I were no longer president. But, I think that there's a certain amount of resilience that's required, you know, for this. So I don't know if he has those feelings precisely. I think that he's got very complicated feelings about Bush, so I can't quite answer it that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, he went to Africa, and one of the things that Bill Clinton has worked on very publicly across the world is halting the spread of AIDS and the AIDS pandemic across the continent. What sense did you get about his relationship with world leaders in their battle, and particularly African leaders in their battle against AIDS?
Well, that's a great question, because you know what's interesting is that he leans a great deal on them to do certain things, you know, whether it's lowering the cost of antiretroviral drugs, because sometimes even though, you know, his foundation is providing them fairly cheaply, you know, the local governments will still insist on charging $6 a month per patient, which in some cases is much too high. And things like that. So he does a great deal of leaning and cajoling and wheedling. And what's interesting is you come away realizing that almost no white guy can get away doing that. these are countries with long, painful colonial histories. And the number of white men who they're going to listen to and take seriously is understandably very few.
Yeah, sure.
And that Clinton is actually one of the rare guys who can do it.
Talk about his meeting. You attended a lunch he had with former South African President Nelson Mandela. And I got a sense during the Clinton presidency, and I've had a chance to talk to Mr. Mandela a couple of times, that there was really a relationship there.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I had lunch with him and the Rwandan President, Paul Kagame. The meeting between he and Mandela was private. All we did was get to meet him. There were about a dozen of us, and he introduced him. But, yeah, the one thing you could pick up off the bat is that there was this intimacy and easygoing thing happening between the two of them that could not, you know, be said of the other African leaders he met. I mean, it was as if he was actually meeting a friend. And I think both of them, Joe Connaughton, who contributes regularly to Air America, he was the one who pointed out that to me, as we were going around, that Mandela, at this point in his life, is really very interested in getting in a good quip and making people feel comfortable. I mean, he's much older now, and
yeah,
he's not in office. So.
Definitely. Yeah. Now, here's the $64,000 question, the one I'm sure everybody's waiting for. What role does Bill Clinton want to play in his wife's possible run for the presidency?
Yeah.
And if she wins, what do you think he's prepared to do?
What does the guy do? I know, it is really a great question. I mean, I don't know. In my story, I actually asked him in a very general way, knowing that he would never dare answer the specific. I asked him, you know, what should the office of the first man be? And he gave this very long, rambling answer, but eventually he said, you know, and Hillary has been so good, you know, was so good during all of my career that I'd basically do whatever she asked me. So basically when I said, what should the office of the first man be? His answer was, whatever Hillary wants it to be. So, you know, I think he's thinking a lot about this.
Really? I mean, is he really prepared for whatever it is she wants it to be?
You know, he made her, you know, the head of his health care task force.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he's thinking is that, you know, she'll contrive some job for him that he'd enjoy. I don't know if it's a diplomat without portfolio. I mean, I think it would have to be internationally. I think that everybody has a much easier time accepting his role. I mean, this is all, you know, nine other things have to happen before we can even really have this conversation. But if it ever came to this pass, I think, you know, he would have to have some kind of role that where he was principally aimed, working abroad. I don't think that people would be especially welcoming of a domestic role for him.
Mm-hmm. Final quick question. There is, I think, and we talk about this a lot on Air America, whenever things seem to go wrong in the Bush administration on a foreign policy level, they seem to try to go back to the Clinton presidency as the origin of the problem. How does he react to that?
That's an interesting question. He spends a great deal of his time saying how eager he was to get Osama bin Laden. He introduces it, you know, at every turn into his conversation. So I'm guessing that while he would explicitly, if you asked him the question that way, he wouldn't want to say anything particularly harsh about the Bush administration or the father or anything like that. However, what he does preemptively all the time is talk about the fact that he was obsessed with Osama bin Laden. So it clearly cuts to the bone in some way, and he wants to make it clear that, no, really, he was extremely, you know, intent on, you know, rooting out al-Qaeda. That's an honest intellectual debate we can all have. You know,
absolutely.
Levels of dedication to, I mean, I think there's blame to be laid at each administration's feet.
Absolutely. Jennifer Senior, thank you so much for being with us. And please, don't be a stranger. We'll have you on again.
Thanks. Sounds great.
You take care. That's Jennifer Senior, and she is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. Coming up in our next hour, boy, we got some show. Michael Penn, musician. And, you know, I hate to put somebody in the context of being someone's brother. But, yeah, he's Sean Penn's brother. We'll talk about his new album. We'll talk about Bush's trip to Idaho next on Air America Radio. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And with us in studio is Dan Pashman.
Hi.
One of Lewis and Linda Pashman. And News Daddy himself, the inimitable Emperor of
Woo!
News.
Oh, please.
That's right. The maven of media.
That's right. Every once in a while, I'm given dispensation to come in here.
That's right.
Thank you.
You guys should have seen the ovation that Wayne News Daddy Gilman got when we were in Harlem on Friday.
Yeah, I was taken back by that. And I tell you, Dan, you are a great warm-up actor.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't understand your role until I got there.
Oh, no, man. Good.
You know, I mean, he works the crowd better than Maron.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we want to thank everybody who came up to Amy Ruth, by the way, because we had a packed house up there.
I know, it was.
It was a really packed house, and we thank everyone who came. And, you know, we're going to be doing it again, but not until September 9th. We're going to be at the New School.
Right.
Right here in New York on 12th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues in the Tishman Auditorium. We're going to have Senator Bob Kerry and a host of others. And Wayne, I guess we're going to have you as a regular
I'd love to.
Drop-in guest.
You know, you see, the thing, Harlem is on the way into the city, into the lower part of Manhattan, so I could easily come and, you know. I don't know about the New School.
Some of your biggest triumphs have taken place in Harlem.
moving right along.
No, actually, no.
It's 7 minutes past the hour, 8 o'clock.
Eastern time.
Right.
No, but see, the thing with Wayne and I started out together in Harlem.
Right.
So, I mean, it really is a, yeah, quiet as is kept. And back in those days, man, I remember we had an engineer who used to open the station because it was a daytime only station back then. So he actually had to come and open the building. And in order to open the building, he had to open one of those locks that's at the bottom of the door.
Oh, right, right.
And half the time he'd come in, he'd be opening the lock, he'd turn around, there'd be somebody standing there with a gun. Yeah, oh, man. That's true. He got robbed. I don't know how many times. Every time you turn around, this Irish guy had a place up on Dykeman Street in Upper Manhattan, for those of you who know the city. And it was just like every time. It was almost like he went like this. He opened the door. But we've gone from that to our elevated bunker here.
And all of this changed. I mean, I was taken back by the turnout Saturday. I mean, on Friday morning.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It was an incredible number of people. Really. There's a big apartment house right across the street. Mm-hmm. Brand new apartment buildings.
Exactly.
Mosque number 7 is still there, though. Right. The Nation of Islam is still up in the Harlem community. So we really did enjoy ourselves. A good time was had.
Right.
By all. By the way, you know, this movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, did you see this, Dan?
Yeah, I did. I saw a screening of it.
Okay, well, it was number 1 at the box office.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Took in 20.6 mil. Red Eye? I don't even know what that was. Story. Is that a late flight?
It's a horror film, a Wes Craven movie.
Oh, Wes Craven?
Yeah.
He still got it, huh?
Yeah.
Wes came in second. Four brothers. Two of whom are white, two of whom are black. They'll explain that in the film, I guess.
Well, it's possible.
Of course it's possible. And then Wedding Crashers, The Skeleton Key, March of the Penguins. Boy, Morgan Freeman must be cleaning up in this.
Yeah, seriously.
Valiant, whatever that is. The Dukes of Hazzard, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Sky High round out the top 10 most watched movies. Mm. I haven't been to a movie in so long, I'm not sure I know how to act anymore.
I saw that March of the Penguins film, actually.
Really?
It was really good. I mean, it's basically like a documentary. I mean, it's a National Geographic type of thing. Mm. But it was really interesting. It's really... I was about to say I'm a big fan of evolution, but that would have been the most asinine statement of all time.
You know, we need to have your parents on the show.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, folks, our president, speaking of hopscotching, he's jumping out of Crawford. I guess when Cindy Sheehan left, I guess it was time for him to get out of Dodge. He's making a stop at a VFW convention in Salt Lake City, Utah,
right,
where protests reportedly are going to be led by the mayor of Salt Lake. Oh, those crazy Mormons. And then he's moving over into Iowa, Idaho. I've seen. Now, Brendan, that's your fault, because he's the one that sent Iowa. So he's in Idaho, home of Mark Furman and the ancient Greeks, I guess. And he's going to be there for another couple of days.
Furman, what's becoming of him?
He's in Idaho. Really? That's all you have to know.
Where he belongs, with the other white supremacists.
Yes. Well, you know, last week a SurveyUSA poll found that the state of Idaho gives President Bush a higher approval rating than any other state in the union, which may, explain why he's there. 59%. Rest assured, if he's going to escape the protesters that have dogged him in Crawford, he is not. Our next guest is on the phone from Boise, Idaho. She's an organizer with the Idaho Peace Coalition, and they have several treats in store for our good president when he arrives in her home state. Let us say good morning to Liz Paul. Liz, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, Bush has a 59% approval rating. Is it you and one other person that is protesting, or are there actually some protesters up there that are really not down with the Bush program?
We have a great lineup of events. We're going to have a lot of people coming out to say a few words that we hope will reach George's ears while he's here in Idaho. That's the problem with these black and white, you know, red and blue kind of things.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, people kind of think that, you know, everybody in the state, that's my mistake, everybody in the state is pro-Bush. And that's not the case. Obviously, if 59% are, 41% are not.
Which is pretty high for Idaho.
Now, you all, the Idaho Peace Coalition, is putting together a vigil in Donnelly, which is up near where Bush is going to be. He's fishing in Idaho?
We hear he's going to be mountain biking.
Oh, not that.
I hope he brought his helmet.
Yeah, really? Is he properly insured? I mean, you know, we're talking about a guy who seems to be running away from reality. At a certain point. You all did have a vigil last week. Is that true?
Yes, we did have a vigil along with those around the country in support of Cindy Sheehan, and that was very well attended by close to 400 people. Yeah, tonight's event in Donnelly, Idaho, at 7:30, they've gotten a private lot. They've renamed it Flower People's Park, and it'll be a great event put on by Valley County Citizens for Peace.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there's more than one peace group in Idaho.
Okay, more than one peace group. Now, do you expect there to be counter-protesters, people supporting the president, who are going to try and drown you out?
We always expect that there'll be counter-protesters. Whether they actually emerge, we're not sure. You know, the pro-Bush, pro-war folks, you know, will have a chance to see the president himself on Wednesday here in Nampa, Idaho, which is right next to Boise.
Dan Pashman, our producer, is here with us as well. He wanted to ask you a question.
Hi, Liz. I'm curious, living in Idaho, what is your perception of those Bush supporters? How would you define them? What types of people do they tend to be, and how do their views come to be in Idaho?
Bush supporters are our neighbors, our doctors, our teachers. They are great, great Idahoans, and they just are looking at the situation in the United States today a little differently than people like I am, and they feel, you know, very strongly that the patriotic thing to do is to support President Bush in his campaign, what he calls against terrorism. Now, we are going to be issuing a citizen arrest warrant for George Bush at our activity tomorrow night.
All right.
And, placing him under citizen arrest for heinous crimes against humanity.
Are you going to be sending him to Bagram Air Force Base or Abu Ghraib if you get him?
No, we're just going to be asking him to report to The Hague.
That's a good point. Liz Paul, how do you and other peace activists in Idaho separate support for this president from support for the truth? Because that really is what he's playing on here. And I think many of his supporters as well, that support for the troops has to mean supporting this president and his policy.
And, of course, it doesn't. And we support our troops. We have military families as part of our organization. These are wonderful men and women. And Idaho has a large number of National Guard in Iraq right now. And the what we need to do is say that we support the troops. These are people, and we support them. We want to bring them home alive, and we want the families in Idaho that are missing their loved ones now for their families to be complete again. And the bone we have to pick is with the commander-in-chief, who used incredibly bad judgment in sending these troops to Iraq in the first place. And he is the one and his administration that are the problem. The troops are doing their job that we expect them to do, which is to follow the commander-in-chief, and he is leading us off a cliff.
Liz Paul, organizer for the Idaho Peace Coalition, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for doing so much heavy lifting out there.
We're happy to do it, and thank you so much for having me.
All right, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, the ultimate irony here is that in 1992, on this day, the siege at Ruby Ridge, which, of course, was in Idaho, is in Idaho, reached its apex. And, of course, there are still lingering questions 13 years down the road about exactly what role law enforcement played. On August 21st, 1992, after a period of surveillance, U.S. Marshals came upon Kevin Harrison, Randy Weaver, and Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky. And in the end, Randy Weaver was wounded. Kevin Harrison was wounded, and Vicky Weaver was killed.
You know, Mark, one of the things that I don't seem quite understand about the state of Idaho and what's going on out there with this unreasonable support for the president, it's almost as if the state is immune to some of the problems that other Americans are suffering in other parts of the country. You know, I mean, she painted a picture where the support is coming from. A lot of the people are professionals. You know, she mentioned doctors, lawyers, and people of that ilk. But, I mean, the thing is, these people are still faced with the problems of joblessness, the huge price of gasoline. I mean, just to take Iraq out of the picture.
Yeah.
Why are
we
still supporting this guy?
Good question.
You know?
Dan, Wayne, thank you very much. Well,
thank you.
And coming up next, our morning remembrance. And Michael Penn, musician extraordinaire, will be here live in studio on Air America Radio's Morning Edition. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
Hi, this is Congressman Gerald Nadler from New York's 8th District, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Marc Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. No, ladies and gentlemen, he did not get fired. No, Dan Pashman didn't pull the rug out from under him, push him down a flight of stairs. Brendan McDonald had nothing to do with it. He's in Hawaii enjoying himself and enjoying his wife. Unfortunately...
Ew.
Huh?
No. Nothing.
What was that?
Nothing. Move along.
What? Did you want to enjoy his wife or something?
Oh, dude.
No, no, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. It's that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Morning, Mark.
Good guys. Morning.
Kalo, Brandon, what's your name? Cashman? Yeah. Let's get on with it. Theodore Shaker, former CEO of Arbitron Ratings Company. No. Last week, the life of Theodore Shaker was canceled. After it was determined not enough white males in the 25 to 54-year-old age group were watching it. Before becoming head of Arbitron in 1971, Shaker worked for 2 decades in network television as chief executive officer in charge of drowning kittens. That's what they do in network television. The company was originally called American Research Bureau, Mark. But Shaker changed the name after hearing that it might alienate minorities. Namely, the 5 people who watched My Mother the Car.
Wait a minute. Was that another one of those minority jokes, man?
Yeah, it was.
I told you to excise that stuff from your script, sorry. You're
trying to put more of your people into the network.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'll tell Chuck D about this.
Where's Wayne? Shaker requested his remains be sent to a random household and a diary be kept on how well his body keeps up after being exposed to 13 weeks of that 70s show. Nothing can make a body decompose faster than that 70s show.
Oh, my God. You know, you sound a little congested, man.
Yeah,
you got to clean that shit? Come on, man.
Yeah, can I have a... Thanks a lot. Oh, yeah, I got a little allergies.
Yes, I understand.
It must be the pomade you use.
Oh, pomade. That's pomade to you.
Pomade.
White people pronounce it pomade.
Yeah. All right. James Doherty, Marilyn Monroe's first husband. James Doherty, an ex-cop whose main claim to fame was being the first of 3 men to be divorced by Marilyn Monroe, died this month, mercifully, just in time to avoid hearing another crappy tribute song by Elton John. After they got married in 1942, he and Marilyn moved into a tiny studio apartment with a pull-down Murphy bed, where Doherty would often pull down her Murphy. Down her Murphy. I got, during his second marriage, Doherty once appeared on To Tell the Truth as Marilyn's first husband. When she found out, his second wife threw a pan at him. It's true. It was then he decided to destroy hundreds of letters from Monroe, reportedly worth a fortune. When she found out, his second wife threw another pan at him. 1986, he ran for congressional office, but lost when the people of his state said they needed a divorce to pursue a modeling and acting career. Family members say they can console themselves with the thought that Doherty's up in heaven getting the crap beat out of him by Joe DiMaggio.
Ah, the clicker.
Yes.
This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying... Where's Wade Gilman?
Next week, all right?
That was a sad one.
That sure was sad, man.
A lot of sad things happened.
And there goes our audience, by the way. Arbitron's not going to do us any justice after that morning.
Yeah, are we going to get delisted for this?
Yeah, we get delisted for this.
We're Nielsen, aren't we?
No.
No, it's the other way around.
No, that's Leslie Nielsen. Forget Leslie Nielsen. This is Arbitron. We are rated by Arbitron, pal.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I hear they're not very reliable. Those diaries? People don't keep the diary.
Oh,
did you ever keep a diary? I never kept a diary.
Hey, we're a network, all right? It's not just one station you can get delisted. There's like 50, all right? So give us a break.
It's that pomade that's doing
it. Yeah. Dixie Peach. Remember that. Go to the store. Coming up next, songwriter Michael Penn. His new album is called Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. He joins us to play live in studio as Morning Sedition continues. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Now, the Morning Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week, Morning Sedition Radio Theater presents The L Word, with Mark Maron as Jenny, Mark Riley as Dana, and a special surprise guest star.
Haven't you ever been to a bar before?
Not a woman's bar. By myself? This is like something out of the 1950s. It's so butch and femme.
Well, it's the oldest lesbian bar in L.A. Actually, it probably hasn't changed since the 1950s. But really, it's no different than any other club. You know, I mean, you have a few drinks, you talk to a few people you have nothing in common with, and you realize how unlikely it is you'll ever meet anyone who's right for you again.
Huh. Wow. Who's that woman?
I don't know, but she's coming over.
Excuse me, ladies. I just moved into town from Chicago, and I'm still meeting people out here. Can I buy either of you gals a fuzzy navel?
Don't you think you're being a little forward? We don't even know your name.
I'm Jane Gillman.
This has been The L Word on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Ah, yeah, it's 35 past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. The laugh you heard in the background is none other than Dan Pashman. BMAC, Brendan McDonald is here with us as well.
Yeah, I don't have a discernible laugh. So
you don't have a discernible laugh.
Dan well, has an A. McMahon kind of
It's great, right, yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Johnny! Hey-o!
Yahtzee!
Well, you know, Chris Lopresto is here with us in studio as well. And shortly, we'll be hearing from Michael Penn, and he'll be playing some music for us live in studio. And for those of you who are just waking up, no, they don't have an Iraqi constitution yet. Maybe later, maybe not. There's more heat on Sir Ian Blair in London after he says he didn't know anything about shooting the wrong guy for 24 hours, even though some of the people who worked for him were openly talking about it. And there's a really whack story about a guy who, you know, I don't know how people in New York end up thinking they can seriously contend for elected office, much less statewide elected office, by using casually ethnic and racial slurs. But we got one. He is the former mayor of Yonkers, New York, which is a city that borders New York City. His name is John Spencer.
What did he say?
He said that somebody didn't have, quoting here, a Chinaman's chance. I think he was talking about Jeanine Pirro.
Yes.
Who's right. Actually running for the same gig. Actually, this has to do with getting the Conservative Party nomination. John Spencer apologized for using the remark. But he didn't see why the remark would necessarily be offensive.
That's the great part of the story. That underlines what conservatives are. They are inherently racist and casually cruel. I'm sorry that I used it, but really I was using it in an historical context because Chinaman didn't have any chance. That is basically his explanation.
Yeah, it was. And it was a sad explanation. And he only apologized when Asian American leaders jumped all over his case. Now, Mike Long, who I've actually had occasion to talk to, he's the chair of the New York State Conservative Party.
Yeah, what's he do for a career, Mark Riley?
He has a liquor store in Bay Ridge out there by Chris Lopresto. Chris, have you never gone to Mike Long's joint? Because I don't think Chris is much of a drinker.
No, I go to a liquor store, but apparently not his.
Not his.
Because
yeah.
I know the owner and son and daughter of
yeah.
that fine establishment. But I'm actually not familiar with the phrase in question here, the Chinaman's chance?
That's an old phrase.
I think it's just a racist thing that goes back to Chinese indentured servitude on the railroads.
Yes.
in out west.
During the late 19th and early 20th century, but particularly in the late 19th
century. A lot of them dropped dead of heat exhaustion. So the slur being that they don't, you don't have a chance. You have as good a chance as a Chinese person did in actually making it through a day's work on the railroads.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike Long says that Spencer didn't say this in malice. And being that he has apologized, that should put the matter to rest.
And it's such an, like, get a new phrase. I mean, what, right. What are we talking
there was
about?
Mark Maron asked me to look at a journalism book that I had. I was telling him about. Had a lot of good journalism background stuff that I learned in college. And I wanted to show it to him specifically for the one section that said, you know, be careful in the terms of defining people by their ethnicities. And this was a book written 30 years ago, and even then it was still trying to be weaned off of that terminology. It said, for instance, the term Chinaman is no longer appropriate. Use Oriental. It didn't even say, you know, use Asian.
Right, right. Yeah, use Oriental.
But that's the point. This term was racist 30 years ago.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like that's how over the top this is.
But what happened? He couldn't think of Snowball's Chance in Hell. That didn't come to his head.
But that's what I'm saying, Riley. They have this. This is part of their DNA. It's just this hateful, nonchalant hatefulness.
Well, I went to a pizza restaurant with actually both you, Brendan and Dan, and on the wall there was a
I remember that
a newspaper, a front page of FDR, and it calls. It says Japs.
It says FDR
right
gets MacArthur beats Japs into submission.
Yeah.
Like on the front page of the paper.
Yeah,
like,
well, remember that during World War II, the term Jap was considered, that's how they wrote. I mean, that's how they wrote, that's how Americans spoke, because the Japanese were the enemy.
Right.
And, you know, they also used the term Nip. They had various terms for Germans, Jerry's and
Krauts.
Huh?
Well, I'm sorry, but what's a Nip?
Nipponese. Short for Nipponese.
Yeah, that's the I believe Nippon is the Japanese.
Nippon, yeah, right, it's a Japanese term. So, yeah, and these were all derogatory terms. Speaking of derogatory terms, you know, somebody secretly recorded private conversations to Governor Pataki, this is New York Governor Pataki, and his wife Libby, and former New York Senator Al D'Amato. And you want to talk about some inappropriate terms.
Yeah, Libby's got a mouth on her.
Yeah.
And by the way, several times.
This cassette is labeled, quote, a Pandora's box.
Well, it's a Pandora's box because of security concerns, I would say, is the fact that the sitting governor and at the time a sitting senator in the state were being tape recorded of private conversations. That seems like a major breach of security concerns.
Yeah, it certainly would be. Now, these were recordings that were made apparently during the middle of his first term in 96 and possibly in 97. A spokesman for Governor Pataki, by the way, this came into the hands of one Frederick U. Dicker. Now, most of you in America don't know who this guy is, but he is the New York Post's Albany bureau chief, and he hates. And now, he is a conservative Republican, but he hates George Pataki. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Fred had a cassette player himself.
He's got a boombox. He's like Radio Raheem walking up and down the street playing this.
Hey, listen to what I got. Hey, you want to hear Libby drop the F-bomb a few times? I got it.
He's got it remixed by Danger Mouse at this point.
Absolutely. You know, we're almost out of time because we're going to make way. Well, we're not going to make way, but we're going to bring in our guest, Michael Penn, who's going to be playing some music from his new album, which is called Mr. Hollywood Jr., 1947. Coming up next here on Air America Radio's Morning Edition, it's 41 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning Edition on Air America Radio.
The hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. He won't even be back next week. We'll be back actually the day after Labor Day. We've got two very special guests joining us in studio. The new album is called Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. It was released on August 2nd on Mimeograph Records. And there's going to be an in-store signing featuring our guests at J&R Downtown tomorrow, Tuesday, August 23rd at 1 p.m. That's both a performance and a signing. And it is a pleasure to welcome to our microphones Michael Penn, and he will be accompanied this morning by Mr. Buddy Judge. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Tell us, first of all, Michael Penn, a little bit about your work. I know that you are a person, like many artists that we have here on Morning Sedition, who believes in a degree of independence, a degree of control over your own work. And I think that may involve, to some extent, ending up at loggerheads with, I guess you would say, big music, you know, the big record companies and that sort of thing. How has that experience been for you?
Downright bizarre, actually.
Really? Tell us how.
Well, you know, I got signed. My first record kind of became popular in 1990, and I was signed, you know, at a major record label, and I just experienced firsthand what, you know, it's a very old story, and a lot of people have been through the same crap and stuff. But basically, you know, the people that signed me left, and they were the people that actually had interest in me, and then the people who moved in, the new president of the label, and all that stuff. They didn't have interest in me, and yet they wouldn't release me from this contract, and in fact they wouldn't let me make a record for 4 years. So it's this weird sort of dynamic where you're with people who wouldn't have signed you in the first place, and yet they won't let you go.
They wouldn't release you? What was their reason?
I think that if you were to, like, sit a record company down on a couch and analyze them like a person, you would find that they were clinically insane.
Tell us about Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. This is an interesting time. It's 2 years after the end of the war, and this is kind of a snapshot of that time, is it not? Or at least metaphorically.
Well, yeah, it was for whatever reason, I was writing a batch of songs, and I was just mentally placing them back in that period of history in L.A., which I just have always been really interested in. It's just, to me, that period between the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War is just a fascinating period of American history, and that year in particular, 47, was just a crazy year for events and things, and many of the events of that year, I just felt were sort of coming to fruition in current events. And it's the year that Palestine was divided up. It's the year of the National Security Act, which means the formation of the CIA and the National Security Council and the National Security State. And this is actually, my two favorite things are the original name of what Eisenhower called the military industrial complex was the National Military Establishment, which they got rid of because the initials were enemy. and then the other thing that I mean, I admittedly have sort of an Orwellian view of all this, but my favorite little tidbit is it's the year that the Department of War was renamed the Department of Defense.
Still in the same spot, though, sure. Yeah. Now, you're going to perform a song off Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. You're going to be accompanied, as we mentioned, by Buddy Judge. Which song are you going to play for us?
The only one I think I can sing at this hour of the morning.
You should be here at 4 like we are.
Yeah, I know. It's called A Bad Sign.
Sign. for days. Can't find a position I will not reverse. The paper prints a simple phrase. But all I see are ciphers in iambic verse. It's a bad sign when I'm just marking time. A bad sign hoping we'll be fine. A bad sign when I think this way. It's a bad sign. I hear a far off sound. It's kind of like a battleground. Hey, something's going dangerously wrong. Evacuate the premises and take what you can carry, says a voice that sounds an awful lot like it's for real, but it's not. It's a bad sign when I'm just marking time. A bad sign hoping we'll be fine. A bad sign when I think this way. It's a bad sign. I'm just marking time. A bad sign hoping we'll be fine. A bad sign when I think this way.
All right. Very nice. Very nice. Michael Penn, accompanied by Buddy Judge, and you're going to be doing an in-store signing and performance at JNR Music World downtown Manhattan tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Real quickly, why you do a lot of work with films. Why? Do you approach it differently, recording for an album, for example, than doing films?
The main reason is because there's no money in the other thing I do, so there's a few bucks in film stuff. I actually got into it begrudgingly, because this guy Paul Thomas Anderson wanted me to score his first film. So I started doing a few things, and it's actually a lot of fun and really interesting, and I've been very lucky to do very interesting films, so it's been great.
So it's obviously gotten you a lot of notoriety as well.
Yeah, a bit.
Certainly. Michael Penn, Buddy Judge, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks for having
us. This morning. Really appreciate it. Again, those of you who want to hear more, you can pick up the album Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947, or you can go down to JNR Music World downtown tomorrow. That's in Lower Manhattan. What is that? Park Row, I believe it is, in Lower Manhattan. And at 1 o'clock, there will be a signing and performance. Right now, we're going to hand the ball over to our good friend, Mr. Kent Jones.
Okay, there it is. Now it's time for this week's liberal agenda. It's the facts from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders. Get out a pen. One, suggest that Bush wear that bike helmet all the time to prevent any thinking-related injuries. Two, propose plan to turn abandoned buildings in Gaza into personal growth and self-actualization centers for children. Three, smash the glass ceiling, but be sure to recycle the glass. Four, drive hybrid car to rally against hybrid corn. If there's any irony in this, just ignore it. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Say, whatever happened to that whole thing about Karl Rove giving away national secrets? Did I just imagine that? Wake up, sheeple. Blink for too long and we settle back into the status quo of lies.
All right, Kent Jones. Nice work. Whoa.
All right, I was just doing that.
Did you hit
thing
that?
Away.
Whoops. I'm not real schooled with this thing.
Let's land this thing.
That's right. Let's land this thing. Our next live broadcast will be our biggest broadcast ever. We'll be at the New School on Friday, September 9th. We'll have former Senator Bob Kerrey and The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert Friday, September 9th at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues from 6 to 9 a.m. And tomorrow, here in studio, New York Times columnist Bob Herbert. His latest column is about recruitment and some of the things that people are doing to get folks into the service. Peter Moss will be here. He'll talk about Saudi oil. Plus, we'll plug in that old iNews 5000. We'll bring you another edition of the Slander Minute, and we'll see what Maren Stalker does while his prey is away. God, am I going to have to deal with this guy every day this week?
I don't know. It sounds pretty serious.
Yeah, it sounds pretty
He's
scary.
He's determined.
Well, my thanks to all the guests that were with us this morning. Our thanks to Chris Lopresto on the board over here. Thanks to Kent Jones. Thanks to, what's his name? The other guy that was in here doing the morning remembrance. What's his name?
Yeah.
Oh, Jim Earle. Yeah, I remember him.
Jim Earle.
And, of course, Dan Pashman and B-Mac, Brendan McDonald. I'm not going to call him PW anymore. That is
old school? We're
that's old
that.
School, that PW.
It's tired.
Yeah, it is. I mean, what are you going to do, man? I mean, the guy is not really PW, is he?
No, I didn't. B-Mac.
Yeah, B-Mac. B-Mac works. Give him a street handle. I'll get him a hat, too. I'm going to go down to...
I think we should all get hats.
Yeah, we should all get this. The Kangol joints, all right? Have yourselves a great day. We'll see you tomorrow at the same time, same station.